the clouds or the sky, we can tell where the sun is because there's a little brighter spot in the sky. So there's some indication of the sun. There's a bright spot there in the sky, but we don't see clearly. So that is also not lost. So in this way, the holy name is considered to be like the sun in the clear sky. And when the sky is clear, then the sun, its light is very powerful, and we get full effect in the heat and light. If we have clouds in the sky, then the heat is not so much, nor is the light so much. So due to the obstruction of clouds, the full potency of the sun is not there. In the same way, the chanting of the holy name is like this. The name is there, the name is spiritual, like the sun. But if there are obstacles in the way, then we do not get the full effect of the holy name. Because the obstacles, just like clouds in the sky, they obstruct and then you don't get the full effect. So when obstacles are there and we chant, therefore, we get partial effects. That is called namavas. So what are the obstacles involved? Two basic categories are there. One is ignorance or avidya, and the other is anarcha, which means the three obstacles, material desires, basically. So ignorance, of course, it means no knowledge. It means no knowledge. So there's different types of ignorance also. Bhaktivinoda Thakur classifies four categories of ignorance. One is ignorance about Krishna. If we don't know who Krishna is and we chant the holy name, that is all namavas. We get effects still. Like Asanyo got effects, saying Narayan, he got effects. But you don't get the full effect. So, if we chant without knowledge of Krishna, then we only get partial effects of the holy name. That's the type of avas. And if we chant without understanding the nature of jiva, our position, now that we're a servant of the Lord, if we don't accept that, and we're ignorant of that, we chant, that's also namavas. And we should also be aware of the holy name as part of sadhana bhakti, that this is non-different from Krishna, and we use it as a sadhana, but it is also the perfection. Chanting the holy name is also the level of prema. So we have to understand clearly what the holy name is. It's not a material thing which we give up later on when we attain spiritual life. It is an eternal process. And so we have to be clear about the holy name also. That's the third thing. And the fourth thing is we should have an understanding of what is Maya. Maya is not completely illusory, it's actually real. But in contact with the jiva, we get a lot of problems. And we have to free ourselves from this material energy. And it's not spiritual, it's material. It's different from the jiva. And we have to separate ourselves from this material energy and establish our relationship with Krishna. So, therefore, we have to know four things. We have to know the nature of Maya, the nature of jiva, the nature of Krishna, and the nature of sadhana bhakti and chanting the holy name. And we have to be very clear about what these things are. If we don't, then we do not get the full potency of the holy name. It will be, these are some of the obstructions. So I mentioned the other day that Sambandha Gyan is very important. So basically this is what Sambandha Gyan and Avidya is, and Prayojan, all involved in these things. So if we don't have a clear idea about who Krishna is and who the jiva is, then the effect of our chanting is limited. So therefore we do need knowledge. We do need some philosophical knowledge when we chant seriously. Otherwise we don't get full effect. So that is called ignorance. And of course, how do you remove ignorance? By knowledge. So that is why we need Shastra, and we need devotee to teach us about what is in the Shastra. So we have a devotional association, then we can get someone again, and we can also get instructions on the process of chanting Sadhana Bhakti. So this will clear up the ignorance. So that is not so difficult. In this way we get rid of one blockage. Now the other blockage is the anarthas. The anarthas, of course, are also various. There's different types of anarthas. One is called asat Krishna. Asat, of course, means material, not spiritual. Krishna means thirst. Basic material craving or thirst. Asat Krishna. So we have, this is also divided into four types. We have four types of material thirst. Thirst to enjoy now in the material world. You have a body, you want to enjoy in the material world. That's the general one that most people nowadays go for. In Vedic times, of course, they had a thirst for going to upper planets. After next lifetime, they go to the upper planets, Svargaloka. So aspirations for Svargaloka, that's another type of anartha. Another one is desire for siddhis, powers through yoga, mystical powers. And the last one is desire for liberation, mukti, impersonal liberation. And so all these desires are considered unfavorable for chanting the holy name and for bhakti. So if we hold these desires, then that is also an anartha, and that's a blockage to the holy name. The second type of anartha is called weakness of heart, or hridaya dorbalya, weakness of heart. This is more or less an extension of the desires, especially the desires in the present lifetime. So we'll develop, through the desires, we will develop very strong obsession with material things, loba, essentially. We get absorbed in material, great material attachments. And then we can also get involved in deception and cheating and lying and things, untruthfulness, in order to achieve these goals. And then we can also get involved in envy and anger and things like this, because we get frustrated in our pursuit of these material things. And we also develop a desire for pratishtha, that is positional power, control of other people in the material world. So these things are all considered weakness of heart. They're basically extensions of the desire to enjoy, and they get perverted into different things. And enjoyment takes specific objects, and then gets frustrated, and then makes certain tactics to get those things, dishonestly, whatever, and develops anger. So these are also anarcha, and if we display these things, we indulge in these things, then this is also an obstacle to getting the full power of the holy name. Then the last anarcha is called aparad. Now this is under namabhas in this stage. When it is not continuous and serious and completely hostile to the devotees and the Lord and to bhakti, then it is still considered under namabhas. So therefore aparads are there, the nam aparads are there, which we all know. And we have seva aparads, that is offenses in deity worship, or concerning the deity, such as disrespecting the deity, coming in the deity room with your shoes on, being unclean before the deity, arguing before the deity. These are seva aparads. And then we have Vaishnava aparad, and then we have jiva aparad. In other words, we have offenses against bhakti and the holy name, nama parad. We have offenses against Krishna, seva parad. Offenses against the Vaishnava, Vaishnava parad. And offenses against jivas in general, in the material world, jiva parad. So four types of aparads are there. So these also tend to cover up the potency of the holy name. So the anarthas, of course, are maybe a little more difficult to remove than the ignorance. If we hear properly, we can get rid of the ignorance. But then the anarthas, even if we hear, still the desires remain, and the problems remain in our hearts. So they're more difficult to remove in general. Nevertheless, as long as they're there, the holy name does not fully manifest its power. So we have to remove also the anarthas. How do we do that? Again, we have to take good association, and we have to follow the instructions properly for chanting the holy name. What is the effect of Namabhas? Namabhas is a nice punya. So if we chant impurely, if we have either ignorance or anarthas and they have a lowly chant, we still get effect. So one effect is you can get nice material results. You can get rid of your diseases, you can get free from anxiety, you can become peaceful, you can get rid of hellish punishments, as Ajamil did. You can get rid of ghosts and other things. You can get rid of the effects of bad planets in your chart. All these things. You can get artha, dhamma, karma, artha, dharma, artha, karma, moksha. The four aspirations of the Varnashram system, you can get these also. Ultimately, you can get this moksha or liberation through Namabhas. Haridas Thakur had a discussion once with some people in Bengal, and then he was glorifying the holy name. And he quoted from Bhagavatam and other places, the holy name is so great that even if there's Namabhas chanting, that is not pure chanting of the holy name, some partial effect of chanting, still, that is strong enough to give you liberation. And then one person there, a very proud person, said, oh, how can this be? To get liberation is so difficult. And yogis will have to practice for many lifetimes to get liberation. You're saying just chanting carelessly, and I'm about to get liberation. He said, this is not right. And he insulted Haridas Thakur. Everyone there was very offended by the actions of this person. Haridas Thakur, of course, was very humble, and he didn't in any way offend that person. Later on, that man got leprosy. His nose fell off. And it was all right. So Haridas Thakur was saying, yes, Namabhas is so strong that you can get liberation even very easily with that. So these are the effects of Namabhas. And then, by chanting Namabhas, of course, if it is accidental chanting, like Ajumil, then you can develop faith by this Tapa Namabhas. And if you're chanting with faith, of course, then you can get even better results than that. So, Namabhas has two types. One is called Hela Namabhas, that's with no faith. And that will lead to developing faith by doing this. And this type of Namabhas with no faith has also different varieties. One is the type that Ajamil did, that's called accidental. You would say the name of the Lord, but it means something else. It's called Sanket. So, Ajamil chanted the name of Narayan because that was the name of the sun. But it's not because he's calling out Vishnu. He's not calling out Vishnu. He's calling out for his son. His son is named Narayan. So that's Namabhas. Accidental. In the same way, the Muslim, he's hunting in the forest or wandering in the forest, and the wild boar attacks him, gouges on his stomach here, and he's laid dying on the ground, and then he says, haram, haram. This is such a ignoble way to die, like a big pig. So he chants the name of Ram in the process, even though he's not intending to say the name of Ram, Ramchandra. It comes out in his speech, so therefore he gets benefit from that also. That is another type of accidental chanting. So that is one way. Then joking. We say the name of the Lord in a joking manner. Sometimes the people in the material world, they say Hare Krishna, joking like that. They're drunk or something like that on the street and start dancing like this. So that's called parikas, or joking. Nevertheless, they get benefit from that also. Maybe there is a little bit of bad feeling, their mocking feeling, but still it's tolerated, and they get some benefits from that. And then it gets a little worse, it becomes derision. Stoba, it's called derision, as in the case of Shishupala, where he's saying the name of Krishna, he's making fun of Krishna and saying he's a low-class, you know, person, not a kshatriya, actually he's, by trickery he became a kshatriya, but actually he's a vaishya, and he made all sorts of comments about him. But still, Krishna tolerated that also. So even that is considered in Navabhas. And then the fourth type of this type of faithless chanting is called Hela, or disrespect. We actually disrespect the Lord. That is getting into actually Aparada at that stage. That's the borderline stage, and you go a little further than disrespect and you get outright Aparada. But nevertheless, these are considered, you get some effect. And there's no faith, but you get some effect. And especially the Sankhya, the first one, is the best of these. And through that you can eventually get some nice faith. So we see that Ashmil did develop faith, and then he chanted Sudana later on. The other type of Namabhas is Shraddha Namabhas. That is where you chant with faith. You already have faith, and you accept the holy name, and you begin chanting it. So that is superior to the Hela Namabhas, which is without any faith at all. And this Shraddha Namabhas will eventually lead to Sudana, or pure chanting of the holy name. But it takes time. Like continuing to chant in Namabhas, eventually you become purified and you'll come to the level of Sudana. But it'll take time. So this is preferable to the Namabhas without faith. It's quicker. But in that process, we can speed it up by avoiding bad association, especially mind bodies, and by taking good association with devotees of the Lord who are chanting purity. And that will speed up the process. And in the process of Namabhas, when we're doing Namabhas with faith, if we take good association, and then we learn scripture, and we learn the process properly, then we can get rid of ignorance, and we can also begin getting rid of the anarthas. So then, quite quickly, we can come from Namabhas to Sudana. Namabhas itself will not give us Krishna. It will bring us up to destruction of karmas and mukti. And with devotional association while doing Namabhas, then we can actually quickly come to pure chanting of the holy name. When we chant purely, that is with no ignorance, with no anarthas, then we are qualified for Krishna. We can get Krishna quite quickly with Sudana. So, there's another type of Namabhas called Pratibimba Namabhas. Pratibimba means a reflection. A reflection such as in the water. We see the sun gets reflected in the water, but the water has little waves in it. So the reflection is not our likeness, it's broken up by the waves. So therefore we'll get little pieces of sun and the wave. And so this is called distorted Namabhas. An example of that, of course, is chanting the holy name with very strong desires for liberation. That is impersonal mukti. If you chant the holy name but you actually desire to get impersonal liberation, this is called Pratibimba Namabhas. It looks like the other Namabhas, but actually our intention is not to even go to the Lord at all. This is simply to get out of the material world. And we're actually negating Krishna by going to the impersonal Brahman. So that's considered not real Namabhas actually, because it never leads to Krishna. That's a Pratibimba Namabhas, or distorted faith. So therefore, Namabhas is one stage which most people start at once they get faith. Of course, you start before you have faith, the four types are there, but it's preferable to start with faith. But we should also aspire to get beyond Namabhas. Because if you simply chant Hare Krishna and Namabhas, then it's a slow process. Okay? So therefore, we have to somehow get rid of the ignorance and get rid of the anarthas, and we do that by taking good association and learning the scriptures properly, learning the process, and then following very diligently. So if we do that, then ignorance disappears and the anarthas also will dissipate very quickly. So, same question there. So far.
What is the Kapibinda Namabhasati distinct from Hela category?
It's very similar. The Hela is actually the borderline. It goes right into Aparad from there, actually. And the Pratibinda Namabhasati actually is also Aparad. But it's it may look like, the person may look very similar to the devotee chanting, when actually his intentions are completely different. So it's actually false. A false Vaishnava, a false chanter of the holy name, actually. That's why it's called Pratibimba, distorted. It's not the real thing. We get the same thing in Bhava. Bhava, there's two types of Bhava. There's the Chaya, and there's a Pratibimba there, or the two types of Abhas, Bhava Abhas. They look like they have ecstatic symptoms of Godhead in Bhava, but actually, they don't, they're not real symptoms. One of them is a real cheater, that's a Pratibimba Bhava Abhas. And the other one is, well, he's... a neophyte, let's say, but he does, his sentiments are not devious. He's just a neophyte, that's all. But he may display some artificial or temporary symptoms of bowel also. So of the two, the Pratibinda is worse because actually it's devious. It doesn't really have faith in the Lord. So similarly, we have the Pratibinda Namabhas and the other Shraddha Namabhas, which is also Chaya Namabhas also.
None of us can connect with Jiva Krishna?
No. It gets rid of our karmas and gets us the mukti, liberation from the material world. One has to chant purely to get Krishna.
Maharaj, what's the difference between one who tries to attain mukti and liberation and one who actually sees that he is a spiritual being? And he doesn't need material energy to make him happy. He's fully satisfied, self-satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
There would be a difference in this group.
Well, the difference is the goal. If the goal is only to get out of the material world, finish. That's all, to get out of the material world. And then we don't get Krishna. But in the process of devotional service, we also do develop detachment from material world. But that's not our goal. That's a side effect. The real goal is to become attached to Krishna. In the process, we become detached from material world. So therefore, it's a side effect. There's no problem with that. That's a symptom. That's not the goal. But where it's only the goal, then it's no different from impersonal liberation.
But it assists one in actually being attached to Krishna if one is detached.
Yeah, that's also there. Yeah, if one is not detached, then it means you're not actually attached to Krishna. You're attached to the material world, and you're not attached to Krishna.
Even the natural attachment came
in. In other words, the more we're attached to Krishna, the less we're attached to anything in the material world. And the more we're attached to the material world, the less we're attached to Krishna.
But that attachment has to be with knowledge.
Huh?
But that attachment has to be with knowledge.
Well, if it's not with knowledge, proper knowledge, then it's not real attachment to Krishna. We're attached to Krishna, but we don't know who he is, then what is that?
Thank you.
During that process, by getting attached to Krishna, the detachment to the material world happens, or do you have to separately endeavor for them?
No. No. Of course, there's some minimum standards. The minimum standards are rules and regular principles. That's the minimum. That's our detachment. That's where we start from. And then beyond that, as we cultivate bhakti and become attached to Krishna, then we'll give up more of the things, the material desires. So it's not separately cultivated, it's just included in there, but we do have a minimum standard to start with. That's the four regular principles.
Material benefits that can be attained through Namabhas. Well, is it that we would achieve some chant Namabhas, and we get some insight, some things to attain those things?
benefit, you do.
Why would we say that someone might be tempting them about not...
Oh, he's not getting all those benefits.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Well, it comes slowly. That's another thing. Huh? In Namabhat, everything comes slowly. If one fully surrenders to Krishna, Krishna says, I take away all your karmas, everything. So, if one surrenders to Krishna in 1 minute, then everything is finished. But generally, we don't surrender immediately. It's a gradual process. So, in Namabhat, of course, in itself, it's not pure. If we did pure chanting, then these things would also be achieved very quickly. In Namabhat, they're achieved, but in a gradual way. So, gradually, the karmas will dissipate through this Namabhat. But it's not all at once, it's a gradual effect.
What is the one spiritual enhancement is our permanent bank account?
Yeah.
Spiritual bank account.
Yeah.
But then what's the position of someone who withdraws from spiritual life and from chanting?
Oh, well, stay there. As long as it's not commit offense. If he commits offense, then the bank balance goes down that way. You get lost. If you just stop, there's no problem. Krishna forgives you for that. And then you just have to continue later on. That's all. And so it just delays your progress, that's all. But it doesn't destroy it, whatever faith was there. If you become hostile to Krishna or the devotees or the process of bhakti, then that can minus. Any questions?
This word Rajiva Quran is basically crimes against humanity and...
Or animals in our plants also.
Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. Generally we don't mention that. We don't see that so much. But Bhaktivinoda mentions it. But we do see it in the Nectar of Devotion. The 20th Aparad, our 20th Anga of Bhakti. There's 10 things you should do, then there's 10 things you shouldn't do in bhakti. Huh? And so the 20th one, the number 20, is do not disturb other living entities, pranis, anything that has life, you should not disturb them unnecessarily. So in other words, no violence, that's our standard. To minimize the violence. So animals, plants, human beings, anyone, we don't purposely afflict them and cause them problems for no reason at all. Shouldn't do that. Otherwise, then become an aparad also. It's a type of aparad.
Who's that
weed? Weed, okay. Well, we could say that's necessary for growing the flowers for Krishna or whatever, so that's not so problem. So we start the Nama Parads. Now, as I said, the Nama Parads are actually included with the Nama Bhans also. But when they become more prominent and continuous and hostile, with a more hostile feeling, then they become very detrimental to bhakti. But when they're within the Nama Bhans, you can still progress. That is that you don't have hostility, it's not really intentional, disrespect, etc. But maybe a little bit out of ignorance or whatever. But when it becomes very intentional, then it becomes very detrimental to bhakti, and it can destroy bhakti. So Bhaktivinoda next dedicates 10 chapters to the aparads, the namaparads. Namaparad means, of course, an offense against the holy name. It also refers to an offense against bhakti in general. And the namaparads, of course, are connected to the holy name. So, of course, we see in here, sadhu-ninda, that's about the devotee of the Lord. But the devotee of the Lord who is distributing the holy name, one who is preaching the glory of the holy name, if we criticize him, that's an offense. So they're all related to the holy name, all of these different offenses. However, we also see that Bhaktivinoda also classes Vaishnava Aparad as a separate aparad, besides the Namaparad. He puts it in a separate category. But in the Namaparad itself, we also have Vaishnava Aparad as the first offense out of Linda to criticize the devotee who's dedicated to preaching the holy name. So that's also Vaishnava Aparad. That's included within Namaparad also here. And so there's a little overlapping. Anyway, the first aparad is called Sadhu Ninda, Ninda, of course, means to criticize. Sadhu means one who is sat, one who is a devotee. So there's different definitions or different qualities given of the sadhu or the devotee of the Lord. Many qualities are given in Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita. But there's one main quality to define the sadhu, and that is surrender to Krishna. That's the main quality. Surrender to Krishna and surrender to his name. The other qualities are called secondary qualities, and they will develop with the surrender to Krishna or chanting of the holy name. They should automatically develop. So this surrender to Krishna has got nothing to do with other qualities such as varna or ashrama. Doesn't depend on your birth, doesn't depend on which ashram you're in. So surrender to Krishna can appear in a grihastha or a brahmacharya, or a sannyasi or a vanaprastha, and a brahmana or a sudra or a lesha. So therefore a sadhu cannot be defined in terms of material designations at all. Of age or sex or varna or ashrama or anything. Surrender to Krishna is beyond that. And it can also be limited by wealth or by learning, by beauty, strength, followers. These are all superficial things. So in judging of sadhu, the jetva, surrender to Krishna. That is a main measure of sadhu. Other things are all secondary. We do, however, make some distinctions between grihastha sadhus and sannyasita sadhus, or renounced sadhus. And accordingly, they have to follow certain rules in order that we respect them. So the grihastha have some rules, and the sannyasis have different rules for conducting themselves. But we cannot say that the sannyasi is automatically superior to the grihastha. It only depends on the surrender to Krishna. The other things are all external. Now, the sadhu may still have some faults or some traces of sin. He may not have all the qualities developed. There's a whole list of qualities, but the chief quality is surrender to Krishna. But even that surrender to Krishna may not be complete, maybe partial only. So he may not have perfection, whatever, like that. However, we should not, therefore, exclude him from the category of sadhu or devotee. Another quality of the sadhu, of course, he does not criticize other Vaishnavas. He does not commit sadhana. So the sadhu actually is very important. The sadhu is a representative of Krishna. He's a Vaishnava. He's surrendered to Krishna, or attempting to surrender to Krishna. And when he comes to the, at least the Madhyamadhikari stage, then he possesses Krishna's bhakti shakti, or the power to impart devotion, which consists of Ladini and Santa shaktis of the Lord. And so these are given by Krishna. And the sadhu then preaches in the material world and is able to spread out Krishna's bhakti shakti to other jivas. And jivadoya, he gives out the mercy of Krishna. So he's very important because Krishna does not come all the time in the material world. He may come only a few times in one yuga. And 400,000 years, he only comes four times. So most of the jivas don't get association with the Supreme Lord himself. But the devotees are there, and they are empowered by the Lord to give out bhakti. So the devotees are very important in this material world, because Krishna himself does not appear all the time, but he appears through his devotee. And therefore the sadhu is very important. So, if the sadhu is there, it's very important to Krishna's eyes, because he is distributing bhakti for Krishna. If we criticize the sadhu, then it's very displeasing to Krishna. Because the sadhu is very dear to Krishna, he's carrying on Krishna's work. And if we criticize the sadhu, then we lose our hope of getting Krishna's mercy. And also, how can we get the help of the sadhus, so we criticize them. And so therefore we cannot advance by committing sadhu-dinda. We'll definitely not be able to surrender ourselves. Now what are the types of ninda? One can criticize the sadhu because of his birth. This of course is maybe common in India, not in other countries, but in India, oh, he comes from a low family, so we won't listen to what he says. It's common in India, you're going to caste conscious. So that is a ninda. We don't take the birth into account. Haridas Thakur was born in a Muslim family, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepts him as the Acharya for the holy name, Namacharya. So he did not take into consideration birth at all. He was a Brahmin. Lord Chaitanya was in a Brahmin family, and most of his associates came from Brahmin families. But he made Haridas Thakur the Acharya, and he was an outcast. So he, by his example, shows that birth is not a consideration. We chant the holy name, all for our sadhu. So we don't criticize a Vaishnava because of his birth. He's not a good sadhu because he comes from the wrong family. No, we can't say that. Then he becomes sadhu nidha. Another way of criticizing the sadhu is, we don't like this sadhu because previously he did this bad activity. 10 years ago or 20 years ago he committed this sinful activity, so therefore we shouldn't consider him sadhu now. So that is also ninda, sadhu ninda. Krishna himself says, even though a person committed the most sinful activity, I still consider him a sadhu. So Krishna accepts a person as sadhu, even though he committed sinful activity. So the devotee also should do that. And we should not criticize him for these previous activities. If he's situated nicely now, we should not bring in the previous activities. Say therefore now, even though he looks like he's doing nicely, he did this before, therefore we should not respect him. So that is another type of sadhu ninda. Then, even in the present time, if one is performing devotional service, he may have some fault now also. Some anartha may appear. Not pure. So some anarthas will appear. That is called a pop ganda, or a trace of a sin. May not commit simple activities as such, but some little trace still remains there, and it may show up in his activities or his speaking or whatever habits. So even to criticize a person for that is considered to be aparad, a sadhu ninda. Why? Because basically he is attempting to surrender completely to Krishna. He's not perfect, but he's in the process of doing so. So his main quality is surrender to Krishna. And these little anarthas that may appear are not considered so important. In other words, we should not look for the faults, rather we should look for the positive quality of surrender to Krishna. And then the last one is called accidental sin. If a person does do a sinful activity, but it's temporary, and he's not always performing sinful activity and repeating the sinful activities. Even if he commits a sin in the present or near present, still, we cannot condemn that person. If he writes himself in his devotional service. Because the scripture says, I accept this person as a devotee. So even then, it's also considered an aparad to criticize him because of that. What is the cause of sadhu ninda? One cause is self is the main cause. Asa sangha. If we associate with people who criticize sadhus, then we also start criticizing sadhus and devotees. In other words, if we associate with non-devotees, basically, then this can happen. Non-devotees are of different types. One type of non-devotee is the mayavadi. Another one is people who pretend to be Vaishnavas but actually have no interest in being Vaishnavas. Not so common in the West maybe, but in India sometimes people dress up and look like nice Vaishnavas with tilak and everything, but actually they go around begging, get money, and then go off and enjoy. So this is a pretender. They act like a sadhu and get donations from people, and then they go off and spend it for their enjoyment. So there's pretenders, materialists, dressed up like Vaishnavas. Another category, outright atheists. They don't believe in God, they don't believe in Brahman or anything. They just believe in working in the material world. No concept of God. So they're also called asat. Another type of asat sangha is, of course, for a man to associate with a woman outside of marriage, that is asat sangha. And for a man to associate with a man who is associating with women outside of marriage, that is also asat sangha. And for a man to associate even in marriage with a woman, but not according to the rules, that's also asat sangha. So all of these things have to be avoided. All these types of asat sangha can be a cause of settling the criticizing Vaishnavas. Now, sadhus are also classified. As I said, the basic character is, the quality is surrender to Krishna. But there's varying degrees of surrender to Krishna. So therefore we have different classes of devotees. We have the Kanishta, the Madhyam, and the Uttama. So the Kanishta is characterized by little faith in the Lord. It's homeless rada. Faith is very weak. And he does not serve the Vaishnavas. He has no respect for the devotees of the Lord. And he cannot distinguish the devotee from the non-devotee. He doesn't really care. And he has no knowledge, no sambandha gyan, no knowledge of who is Krishna, what is a jiva, etc. And at best, he's chanting namabhas. The Madhyama Adhikari has strong faith in the Supreme Lord. He has knowledge, sambandha gyan. He respects the devotees of the Lord. He does service to the devotees of the Lord. He associates with equal Vaishnavas. And he gives mercy to the Kanishthas, lesser, less advanced Vaishnavas. He gives them mercy in the form of instructions and preaching and guidance. He avoids asat sangha, that is all the materialists I mentioned above. He avoids namaparads, including sadhu-ninda, and he chants pure name, sudhanam. That is a Madhya Vaishnava. The Uttama Vaishnava simply sees Krishna in everything. In other words, he realizes sambandha gyan. It's not knowledge of sambandha gyan, it's a realization of that sambandha. And he completely relishes Krishna in the name. In other words, the name becomes non-different from Krishna's form, qualities, and activities. And he gets completely absorbed in Krishna's name. For him, there's no possibility of any namaparad. And he doesn't distinguish Vaishnava from non-Vaishnava at this stage. So these are the three types of sadhu. And they're a little different. The middle class is the one who distinguishes Vaishnava and non-Vaishnava, and preaches to the Vaishnava, avoids the non-Vaishnava, and is very careful to avoid sadhu-ninda and the other namaparas. The Kanishta cannot distinguish Vaishnava from non-Vaishnava, now a good association, bad association. So it's a rather risky position. Uttama is beyond aparas. There's no question of avoiding aparas because he's beyond that. He's already realized Krishna, and he no longer distinguishes Vaishnava from non-Vaishnava or anything like that. So for us, the important person here is the preacher, that is a Madhyam Vaishnava. He is the one who does the preaching work mainly. What is the remedy for sadhu-ninda? One should sincerely regret the offense, and then we should ask forgiveness from the devotee to whom one has committed the offense. So, any question there?
Yeah.
Sadhu means devotee. Or with the sadhu nanda, we mean against the devotee. Sadhu means one who has quality of surrender to Krishna, which means a Vaishnava. And of course, there may be in any of these categories Kanishka, Madhyama, or Uttama. Of course, it's more serious to commit offense against the Uttama, most serious, and then against the Madhyama, and then against the Kanishka. So, according to the person you commit offense against, then it gets more reactions also.
The point of criticizing the word is, like sometimes I feel like that we are individual personalities, we have different ways of thinking, and sometimes we have some difference of opinions and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, sometimes we may get just, because at one point we may get caught up about a person, something else, and that is already blocked in our mind because of that. Not able to appreciate whatever they do.
Mm.
So, in that situation, it's like, what is the best remedy? Like, when it's in the mission to come and happen to the program, they are blocked up because of something happened in the past, you know, because they did something to us in the while ago.
Well, we have to become a little detached from our own honor and dishonor and all those things. And in other words, we have to judge from the amount of surrender, ultimately. And be a surrender, that would take us a good quality. You may have bad qualities, as said here. You may have a trace of previous bad qualities or whatever. But we should also see the surrender to Krishna and give him respect on that grounds. This does not mean we should be blind, also. But at the same time, if a person, we should be able to perceive if a person has sincere desire to surrender to Krishna. And we should give credit to him for that. In that sense, he is a Vaishnava, we should give respect to him on that grounds. He may have sinful activities.
Maybe they are possible.
And we cannot be blind to him, they don't exist. We also have to give credit to his sincerity and surrender to Krishna. And that way we see him as a Vaishnava, apart from the other activities he does. Of course, the person who's doing these sinful activities, if they become prominent and serious, then that he becomes an aparadhi also, because he commits a seventh offense to the holy name. So then, if it's continuous, then he may not be a Vaishnava anymore. So then the rule does not apply in that case.
All right. Quite often we hear the different types of body, we hear Kanishka, but then Uttama, we think, oh, I'm in the Kanishka stage. But at what stage can we actually see ourselves qualified as being Kanishka Adhikari if we don't see Krishna in the deity even?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what are we to not that?
If we're not at that level.
When does one...
Oh, well, you see, the Kanishka Adhikari has respect or faith for Krishna and not for the devotee.
Mm-hmm.
Now, generally, in our devotional service, the main quality, the first quality is faith in Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
So if we cannot, if we don't even start with that, then we're not even at the devotee platform.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean we're means somehow we shouldn't be here. In other words,
maybe I didn't win your question. Is it Kanishka? Would that be considered the starting platform?
Yes.
Because I heard in one lecture one time in Vrindavan, where someone said that we're even lower than Kanishka level. If you don't have faith, if you don't see Krishna in the deity, then you can't even consider yourself a Kanishka, you can't actually lower than that.
Well, I would think that most of the devotees are in the Madhyam platform. Because we do accept, on principle at least, the, you know, Sambandhagyan, Krishna's God, we are the servant of Krishna, the process of chanting the holy name, we're trying to surrender to Krishna. But we do have some anarthas and things like this. And we're trying to get rid of those also. but it's a matter of degrees. So somewhere between Kanishtha and Madhyam, a lot of people would be in there, or lower Madhyam, let's say. Lower category of Madhyam. Because here, Madhyam is one who chants Sudanam. But to have Sudanam, then you have to have proper knowledge, and you're still Aparads and Anarthas are less and less in that stage. Yeah? So generally, we have faith, we have Sambandha Jnan, we give respect to Vaishnavas, we preach, we avoid Asatsanga, we avoid Namaparads, so then that is a Madhyam. Yeah? So a lot of people deal in the Madhyam category. But then, as for Sudanam, chanting the Sudanam, we can see various degrees, let's say, according to the number of anarthas. And generally, the Kanishta is, we would say the Kanishtas are people, they're called not even Vaishnavas, the Kanishtas. They're called Vaishnava Prime. Almost a Vaishnava. And the Madhyams are called Vaishnavas. They're called Vaishnava Praya out of mercy, because a Vaishnava should only associate with other Vaishnavas. So if we don't call them Vaishnavas, then the Madhyamadikaris wouldn't associate with them, wouldn't give them any mercy, so they have no way of advancing. So we call them Vaishnava Praya, include them in the Vaishnava category, though technically the faith is weak and whatever. They don't have the strict sadhus, so we're rather in a pitiful position, actually, most people.
These words, Kanishtha and Madhyam, they're different contexts with different
traditions? Yeah, there's basically two different categories. This is the category from the Bhagavatam. Mm-hmm. And then in the Nectar of Devotion, there's another category within Vaidhi Bhakti, actually, Kanishtha, Madhyam, and Uttama. There, it's according to faith, and faith depending upon Shastra. The one who has no knowledge of Shastra and has very, very weak faith, then he's called a Kanishtha. And one who has some knowledge of Shastra and has some faith is strong enough that he doesn't lose his faith when he gets defeated in argument by atheists or Mayavadis, he is called a Madhyama. And one who has deep faith due to his study in, of Shastra and his expertise in his understanding of Shastra, not only his knowledge, but his understanding of Shastra, his ability to use it to defeat the arguments of opponents, he is called a Uttama.
In another case, I think you read it in Krishna's Samhita, the Vatavana Shastra uses these words, Madhyam, Kanishtha, and Uttama, in ways that are a little confusing.
I don't know.
He describes how the Madhyam is doubtful and the Kanishtha has
In other words, the Madhyam is less than the Kanishtha.
Yeah, the Madhyam has more problems than the Kanishtha.
Well, faith develops by previous Agata Sukritis, which are caused by devotees, then we have a little faith, so we're willing to hear and accept the words of the sadhu. And of course, when he does it, by associating with him, we develop more faith, obviously. So the cause is devotees, but maybe not his, that devotee. We might already have some faith already, otherwise we wouldn't listen to him at all. Or except we challenge his words, we wouldn't listen. We have no faith. But then when we hear, then we get more faith. So the sadhu is also the cause of more development of faith. So we have Shraddha and then we have Sadhu Sangha, and that deepens the faith. Okay, we'll do another one. We did Sadhu Linda. Related to that, of course, is the third aparad, Gura Aravagya. which is disobeying the spiritual master, or disrespecting. Avagya can also mean disrespect to the guru. So guru, of course, is also sadhu, but a particular sadhu. So therefore, there's particular respect for the guru. So the guru is one who has a special function. The general function of the sadhu is he gives mercy to the other devotees and preaches and gives good association, instruction, etc. And the guru is special. One, in that as Diksha Guru, he gives mantra and may give more detailed spiritual knowledge, more detailed than some other can, and guidance in terms of practical devotional service. So he lets a more specialized Vaishnava. What is the qualification? The same as the sadhu. He should have surrendered to Krishna, be free from bodily designations and considerations. The types of guru, the Diksha Guru is the one who gives mantra. It should only be one. You can have many mantra gurus. And he should have knowledge of the Sampradaya teachings and should have good conduct. The other is the Shiksha Guru. One can have many Shiksha Gurus or teachers who give spiritual instructions. And of course, even the founding Acharya of a movement is also considered to be a Shiksha Guru. And the other great Acharyas in the line also are considered Shiksha Gurus. And they're given also proper respect. And everyone in the Sampradaya has to follow the instructions of the Acharyas and the founding Acharyas, and not accept teachings outside the Sampradaya. Now, Diksha Guru, by that we mean giver of the mantra. He may also give the name. In Shastras, sometimes we'll distinguish mantra and name as being different. Though we say Hare Krishna mantra, secondly it's nama. That's a holy name. And mantra means something different. Name technically is simply names of the Lord, independent of any other grammatical, any other words. There's no verb, nothing. It's Krishna, Rama, Gopal, Govinda, that's all. And so it's no statement about anything. Mantra is a little more complicated. The name of Krishna is there. In essence, the mantra also is Krishna's name. It's the name of Krishna. But that name is, grammatically, it is conjugated and has an ending on it, like Krishnaya, or Vishnave, or Chaitanya, whatever, like that. And I have a word to go with that, such as Namaha or Swaha, Krishnaya, Namaha, etc. You have a lead syllable with it, some other syllable like Om or whatever. You put syllables in front, called lead syllables. And I may have other words in there also describing Krishna, whatever. So that is called a mantra. That's the technical definition. And the mantra has a rishi in charge of it, some rishi who revealed the mantra and empowers it. And it has a devata or a lord, Krishna, who is the subject of it. It has a certain chanda, a certain meter, etc. All these little technical things are there. So it's a little more specialized than the name. And it requires more qualification than the name. Name, faith. If you have faith, you give up the holy name. But for mantra, not only faith, you have to have a certain standard of rules and regulations, like four regulator principles, chanting 16 rounds and other things. Then you can get the mantra. Whereas with the holy name, we even tell people who are, you know, outsiders or whatever, you chant Hare Krishna. So the name is more broad. You can give out the name to all sorts of people, provided they have faith. But for people for mantra, we have to see particularly have more higher qualifications. So it's more restricted in getting out. So technically when we say diksha, it means giving out the mantra. That distinguishes diksha from other things. Giving out that mantra. And that's technically in our second, what we call a second initiation. That's giving the mantra then. So that's the essence of diksha. So the so-called second initiation is diksha, so to speak. Of course, in Pancharatra, Diksha refers to five things. One is the mantra, which is the most important. Another is getting a name, such as Krishna Das or Gopal Das or whatever. Another is Tilak. Another is worshipping the deity. And last one is branding yourself, getting brands, which we don't do. In Madhva and Ramanuja Sampradaya, they still do that. They get some metal chunks and chakra and put it in the fire and brand you on the shoulders. We'll be generous enough with that. You can do it with tilak. And get a little wooden stamp with tilak on it and do it that way. Somehow it got out of fashion in North India. Well, South India, they still do it as part of the Diksha ceremony. So that's called Pancha Samskar. So that's technically the samskar for initiation. But the most important thing is the mantra. And with the mantra, you're qualified for the deity worship. Worship of the deity. There's another concept, of course, giving up the name also. Though technically the name is not, it does not need diksha to get the holy name. Haridas Thakur says that the name is independent of diksha. So technically, yeah, it is. Nevertheless, we also say that we shouldn't give the name to the faithful people. And we should not give instructions to the holy name to the faithless people. That, of course, is offense number 9, which we'll discuss later. So then we do have some sort of way of giving out the holy name to qualified people. So that is called giving the holy name, technically. Nam Dan, to give out the holy name. And that person is called Nam Guru, rather than Diksha Guru. Guru has to be respected. This is the tradition. He's a Vaishnava, he's respected as a Vaishnava, but also Guru is a special Vaishnava because he's giving you the mantras, the Diksha Guru, or special teachings. And therefore one has to give some special respect to the Shiksha or the Diksha Guru. And both should be respected equally, Shiksha Guru and Diksha Guru. Why are they given respect? Because they are representing Krishna and delivering the message of Krishna. So we should respect them for that. And not only respect, but we show the respect by service. Different types of service. And there's also provision for worship of the Guru. Called Guru Puja. And if one is to worship Krishna, then one should first worship the Guru. That is the procedure. First to worship Guru, then to worship Krishna. As far as deity worship is concerned. That is the etiquette. Then, sometimes there is also a discussion of rejection of Guru. A Guru may be qualified, in which case we respect him, but due to asatsanga, he may lose his qualification. Due to asatsanga, he can commit namaparads. And to that, he can lose his knowledge or his perspective of things and become hostile to Vaishnavas, lose his taste for the holy name, and then consequently he'll develop other desires as material desires for wealth or women or whatever. So even though he was qualified at one time, due to that association, gradually he can develop prominent material desires. So if this happens, then that guru has to be rejected. If his position is not correctable, not correct in any way, then we can no longer consider him our guru. So therefore we have to reject him. So he's not guru anymore. And reject him. And then one should accept someone else as guru. If we don't reject, then there's a problem. And this is mentioned in the Hari Bhakti Vilas. When we take initiation, we establish a relationship. And we have a vow. The disciple makes a vow to follow the guru, and the guru makes a vow to deliver the disciple. the contract. So we make a little, not written contract, but a verbal contract. Nevertheless, it's a contract. So therefore, there's a relationship established, a formal relationship established at that point. Due to the relationship, if one party is faulty and falls from the position, that will affect the other party. So if the disciple does not live up to his contract, part of the contract, then he commits sinful activities and other things, and he turns away from the path of Vaishnavism, then he can affect the guru because the relationship is still there. And if the guru doesn't fulfill his part of the contract and he falls, then he can pull the disciple in his direction also because the relationship is still there. So therefore, if one is not careful, one can also be affected, and therefore you should cut the relationship at that point. And say it's no longer valid. Because that person is no longer fulfilling his part of the contract, therefore this is no longer a relationship, therefore finished. There's no effect. But if we continue to have the relationship, then we can get affected. Well, as he says here, one then wants to accept another qualified guru. He doesn't specifically say shiksha or diksha, but at least a shiksha guru of some sort. And definitely have to reject the other guru anyway, because if as I said, the relationship is there, then if he goes to hell, you go to hell, kind of thing. Yeah, but still you have to reject that spiritual master.
Yeah, and then you're... You're not disconnected.
Yeah.
From
yeah. But still then you're left without a guru. So that's why they say you seek another guru. But it doesn't specify shiksha or diksha there. Of course, and the other thing is that in order to prevent such things from happening, then one should be very careful about who you choose as a guru. And one should be very, one should have knowledge. In other words, we can't choose unless we have knowledge. And to get knowledge, then we have to put some effort into that. Just like if you're going to go to university and spend many years there, you don't just blindly go to one university, you look at all the descriptions of the courses they offer and the professors in the university and everything. See, it's a nice university and they get recommended by other people. You don't just blindly go into it and waste, 4 years and go through it and find you didn't learn anything. So you have to put effort into your choice. Who you want to choose? You have to, then you have to understand what is the qualification of the guru. And see very carefully. So one should therefore put effort into it. Ultimately, it's one's individual responsibility. One makes the choice, that is your responsibility. You can't blame another person for that. You make the choice, no one else. So therefore, we have to be careful. Therefore, they said it should be a pariksha, or a test. The disciple should observe the guru, if he's thinking of a certain person, he should watch. See? And if he doesn't have full faith, then he should not take initiation from that person. And the guru should test the disciple also, see if he's qualified. If he's not qualified, then he should not take him as a disciple. Because either way, if you establish a contract like that and they don't fulfill the contract, then the other person gets affected and suffers.
As you're saying, we have to, the guru is not following, we have to reject him. What is exactly it means when rejecting the guru means that don't worship him or don't respect him? What exactly it means?
Both those. We nullify the contract and the relationship with him. In other words, when we take diksha, then we are making a contract that I will follow you because you are leading me to Krishna. And then the guru is making a contract with the disciple, I will teach you because you agree to follow certain principles and you do have sincere desires for your Krishna. But if either break those conditions, then it should be rejected. The relationship is cut. So that you no longer consider yourself a disciple of that guru. And you're not obligated anymore to it in any way.
So if someone still attached or does some sentiment, they're not feeling that meaning anything good.
Not so good. Because then relationship is there, so it can influence. Respect. Proper respect to both, anyway.
Sometimes we can only, when we can have a personal relationship with the Diksha and not be able to contact the Diksha.
That's okay.
And in time, we get more attached to the Diksha and Diksha. Sometimes we might even consider maybe the Diksha can take her back to God.
Well, they both can. Shiksha also can take you back, there's no problem with it. But we shouldn't neglect also the Diksha Guru or find fault with him.
The Diksha Guru you can take only after the permission of the Diksha Guru only, right?
Technically that's correct, yeah. Take permission.
And Diksha Guru basically helps the disciple to come closer to the Diksha Guru.
He gives teachings, right? Specialized teachings. Okay, what is service to the Guru? Respect his asan, his bed, his shoes, his vehicle, his shadow. Don't step on his shadow. Don't step over his asan or his shoes or his vehicle, his palanquin. Follow his instructions. Offer pranams, obeisances. Respect his name. Don't treat his name casually. Try to please him. And of course, try to surrender to Krishna as much as possible. Engage in devotional service. Chant holy name. And what is disrespect? To reject the Guru, if he's qualified. Reject him anyway. To disobey him. And the order is devotional. So, this becomes an obstacle to devotion because respect is the cause of advancement. The opposite will be the cause of lack of advancement or obstruction. It's caused by in bad association or reading false literatures, non-devotional literatures, contaminated. What is the remedy? We have to repent and ask for forgiveness. Okay, any question?
Good.
Oh, very good. Good if he does. Well, the disciple is a nonsense, and then he picked up?
And he picked up too, and then at the same time, he had the same group.
Oh, you mean they both fell? Or what?
Yes.
Oh. Well, it's possible, yeah. It's possible again. If he has faith at that time, he could take the group back again as well. As I said, if a person resumes his devotional service, then we give him credit for that, and we don't disrespect him. We look at his present devotional service, whatever that is, and he's doing some good devotional service. Okay, we give him proper respect for that. Of course, if it's 10 years later, and the disciple has gone somewhere else and taken a new guru, we can't blame him for that also. But nevertheless, whatever
that person does if he comes back to the devotional service, we give him credit for that also. And we don't reject him as a Vaishnava.
Could he become a guru again?
It's possible. It's possible.
Can you
try the Namguru? Namguru? One who gives up the holy name and gives teachings on the holy name. Possibly it could be, but I would put our first initiation in that category, maybe. Huh? But the thing about our first initiation is a little bit of second initiation also, because we give the name then also, which is part of the Diksha. So the Diksha is kind of spread out there. But I think in the Gaudiya Mutt they don't do that. So technically the first one is Namguru, who gives out the holy name, just tells you the chant. So it's more distinct in there. Just the mark is a little merged.
But that's
even a
Thakur himself is an example of somebody who rejected
the Diksha Guru,
and he didn't accept another
Diksha. Mm-hmm. Well, there's some controversy whether they actually rejected him. I know Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati definitely rejected him.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that Bhaktisiddhanta nowhere has written that he rejected that guru at all.
But he didn't offer him his direct, he's very, very prominent respect towards the Shiksha.
But we see in his poems, he does offer great respect to them. And actually, he has in his poems, he's his Diksha Guru is in a Manjari form, worshiping in the spiritual world and everything, and identifies him as a Manjari and everything. So he does identify him in his Sarup even, in his poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And in some poetry,
I
don't know what it's stated as, but then he's giving respect to his Guru and everything like that. I don't know which era that is in, but nevertheless, it's there in some of the poems. So he does give great respect at one point. Anyway. Whether he rejected or not, I don't know. Like, I've never read anything in written statements that he did reject him. And maybe that.
Maharaj, what if
Bhakti
Guru left this material world? Should we take up another Diksha Guru?
No, can't. You can only take one Diksha Guru.
So we follow the instruction on it?
Yeah. And the mantra. You chant the mantra, okay? Or Vaishnava mantras. In other words, one of the main functions of the qualifying function of the Diksha Guru is to give the mantra. So he also gives teachings, but of course the Diksha Guru can also give teachings. And sometimes the Diksha Guru may be more prominent, as in the case of Baladev Bhushan. Vishnu Chakravarti was a Diksha Guru only, but he became more prominent than his Diksha Guru who was living in Puri. So, Diksha is the qualifying thing there, the mantra. And even if the Diksha Guru disappears, still the mantra is there. But one can go for Shiksha, definitely.
Guru Parampara, why is that like the Nathas Prabhupada and Kutuna Thakur, they are
Shiksha, not Shiksha.
And why is more context given like that to Shiksha? Shiksha is followed in the Pampa.
This is the line which Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur set up. It is basically a Shiksha line rather than a Diksha line. If you do Diksha line, you may not get all the prominent figures in our Sampradaya there. Huh? For instance, if you take the Diksha line from Gorkhashordas Babaji, then Bhaktivinoda won't appear there at all. Because his guru goes to the Advaita line, right? Advaita Sampradaya, and then it'll lead up to Vedacharya, and it'll also miss Goswami in the process. And if we go through Jagannatha Babaji, we'll go through Vishnu Chakravarti also. But then, of course, there's no Diksha line from him to Bhaktivinoda Thakur either, so. That'll also go in another direction. That'll go through Vishnu Chakravarti, but then it won't include Bhaktivinoda Thakur. If we go to Bhaktivinoda Saraswati, then Bhaktivinoda gets omitted. I guess so. And then, of course, the Goswamis get omitted also. So, I don't know if there's any written explanation why Bhaktivinoda Saraswati Thakur did that, but I would assume because he just wants to include all the major people in our Sampradaya. The Goswami's Vishnu Chakravarti, all the devotion, like that. So, just like that.
Maharaj, is there an offense to disregard
I would suppose so, yeah. You have to give them proper respect, all of them. Yeah. I don't have to see it written down, but give proper respect. That's one thing also. Sure. Disappearance day and appearance days are also respect. With those disciples who are going somewhere else.
Yeah.
Well, as it was said here, generally we should stay within the Sampradaya and within the teachings of the founder Acharya and be loyal to those teachings. That's the best thing.
Well, even I have pictures of Krishna Chaturvati Thakura and Narottam Das Thakura.
I suppose we could, but the altar would get very big also. it would get very big. That's, I think that's the only reason why. In Mayapur, they're going to put all the whole line in there in the temple, in Murti form, in the new temple, all the way up to Madhavendra Puri, all the way up to Lord Brahma. I mean, they're going to go all the way down and have all this is a succession there. Generally, only for practical purposes. I think that's the only reason why.
If one's guru has down, then he said that he has to take an initiation from another guru. When it doesn't have to be a different guru, but he has to take
at least some sort of shelter from someone.
That's
That is mentioned also in Bhakti Sandarbha, Yudhika Goswami. Mm-hmm.
But how about if it means without taking shelter, but if he's still faithful to the process, can he make some advancement?
You can make advancement anyway, but this is the Srila Vidhi and the advice given by the charts. Ultimately, of course, if we have faith in Krishna, Krishna makes arrangement for us somehow or other. But, as I said before, in the process of bhakti, generally we depend on the mercy of devotees all along, and particularly as you go higher and higher. So if you want to get the Bhava Bhakti, then you need the mercy of some devotee, specialized devotee. If you want to get Prem Bhakti, you often need the mercy of a Prem Bhakta. Huh? So somewhere along the line, you're going to have to accept someone as at least a Shiksha Guru, a very prominent Shiksha Guru, to get to the higher stages. Or even a Raghunuga for that matter. You can't learn from a book. You have to go to someone for that also.
And he the Sampradaya, his connection, is it broken?
No. Just the Vidhi is there, that's all. And one should be under the shelter of the Guru, that's all. And if you reject your Guru, then you don't have that Guru anymore, so then. It does create problems in one sense also, because then if that you become a prominent Guru later on, you initiate people, then you don't have a line in one sense, because it stops in that sense, and there's no Viksha line at all after a certain point. Yeah? So it's a problem there. So I think for that reason also, then they can trace the Diksha line. Of course, we don't consider the Diksha line ultimate, but many people do. Many people do, even within the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And that's why Bhaktisiddhanta got attacked. He gave this line that we give in our book. The Babaji said, we don't accept that line. That's not a Diksha line. You want to say you're in a Sampradaya, you give the Diksha line. Don't give this line. And he didn't accept. This is not a line. They wouldn't accept. But we accept the Shiksha or the Diksha, actually, as a prominent thing. But then a question. So that's why that provision is there. We should continue the Diksha line.
So what are the teachings? We just got to follow the teachings of the founder Acharya in the administration and endorse them. Mm-hmm.
That was Bhaktivinoda.
Yes.
Well, it's controversial whether he did or not.
Yeah.
I know Bhakti Siddhanta rejected him because he made some statements about certain people and was caste conscious and all that, so then he didn't want to accept because it was the caste thing there. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I don't know, doesn't, he didn't say directly like that whether he rejected him or not.
So we just have to stick to the teaching for the founder and then follow them.
Yeah, but as I said, ultimately guidance is necessary, and especially the higher you go. So sooner or later, sometime, some lifetime or other, you have to get another guru. If you don't make it in this lifetime anyway, next lifetime you have to start and get another guru anyway. It may not be Dikshu Guru, it may be Shikshu Guru. But the other point is, of course, that if one is sincere, then Krishna makes arrangements for you, so you can advance. But usually, it's only going to be two ways. One to as Paramatma, or one as external guru. One of those two is. Anyway, he'll give you help.
Can you give help as Krishna
instead of Paramatma? Yeah, I suppose. Well, I think when it's Paramatma, internally, whether it's Krishna or Paramatma, it's ultimately. But, of course, if one is higher, then when Krishna would come directly. One is lower, let's say lower stage, then maybe it's Paramatma.
Can you
listen
through the deity, like if you worship
Krishna? True, that's non-different from Krishna.
Yeah.
So you can get direction there also. Mm-hmm. Though some people may criticize that, say you're Sahaji or something. Krishna gives you diksha through Murti Farm or something.
But if you're looking for
Murti
rather than specifically
diksha. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Krishna can get directly through the Murti Farm also. Or through the holy name even, also available.
But by telling the deity, we make it some inspiration, but unless we are very pure enough, we can't quite understand it unless we have some guidance from another guru.
Yeah, also that. So we may need guidance there to get the inspiration from the deity also.
What is the definition you're saying about the mantra?
Mantra, what is a mantra?
Yeah.
A mantra is a name of Krishna or Vishnu. I'm speaking about Vaishnava mantras. But if it applies to the Shiva mantras or anything, the name of the deity will be there. In the dative form, that is in Anku form, like Krishnaya. Krishnaya.
Uh-huh.
You know, like this, Chaitanyaya, Gurudev, Vishnadev. It'll be in the fourth form, dative form. And it'll have
data,
that's called data form.
Data.
Yeah, unto Krishna.
Uh-huh.
And it'll have a word like Swaha or Namaha indicating surrender. I pay my respects to where I surrender unto Krishna. Uh-huh. And then it'll have a bead syllable in, at the beginning usually, like Om or something else. Uh-huh. Particular with each mantra, the different beads are there. Krishna's for Krishna or Vajitanya for a guru or whatever. Specific beads are there. And there'll be other words also describing Krishna and other things like that also. So it's a series of words related grammatically with a bija in front of it. Whereas Nam is just simply the name of Krishna, or Krishna, evocative form, calling out to Krishna, Hare, calling out to Radharani, Rama, calling out to Krishna again. And there's no Namaha, nothing in there. Well, in one sense it is a mantra, one sense it isn't. Like we call the verses of Bhagavad Gita mantra also, actually the verses, but in a general, a very general thing, which are any sacred syllables, mantras. But when we talk about Nam and mantra, then there's a specific distinction.
Mm-hmm.
The Nam has no qualification except faith, whereas the mantra you need specialized qualifications. So there's, and in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that's how it's used. The Nam and mantra, the distinction is there like that.
If it is the Pancharatra process, the five things, five items are there.
Nama. That means name of the servant of Vishnu or Krishna. It's also Dasa.
Uh-huh.
Then mantra, you get the secret mantra. This mantra is secret also. you don't pronounce it publicly and tell everybody to chant that mantra. It's secret, you only chant it. And therefore, you have to get it from the guru because it's secret.
It's like the Gayatri mantra is
secret. Yeah. And then Tilaka, Kurva Pundra, Tilaka. And
that time the teachers have to put the tilaka, or does it exist?
Well, generally you see in some sampradayas you don't put the tilaka until you get initiated.
Right.
Then you're entitled to stick these things, otherwise you don't do it. Of course we all put it on before that, but the other sampradayas are strict. You don't put it on until your initiation, and then you're called Vaishnava. Before that you're not Vaishnava. And then tapa, that means the branding.
Tapa.
And then yaga, or worship, surrender and worship of the deity.
Yaga,
yaga. 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 Which means worship.
Worship of deity, no, worship of deity.
Okay. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.